This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblet.
And this week our topic is...
Oh, wow. Oh, crap. Yeah, that's kind of strange. So that pause is related to my topic, which is kind of funny. So I'll read what I wanted to say, which is I'm promoting my iPad to a first-class citizen computing device world. Or why should I use my iPad more?
Okay, but before that, I hear we have follow-up.
Yep, we do. So, as everyone might know, iOS 8.1.0 is out! Yay! More bug fixes. Good. So, Apple is saying in the release note that 8.1.1 is improving performance on the iPad 2 and iPhone 4S. But some devs and some people were able to verify that it fixes the iCloud bug that we mentioned in the last episode's follow-up. And also, it fixes the last problem I had with extensions, which was the reordering of share extensions and action extension in the share sheet, which is awesome!
Except it's not completely fixed.
Yes. And on the pen notes related to iOS 8.1.1, the download size is up around 65 meg, but you still need 2 gigs to install it.
I think this is going to be a recurring pattern going onwards, where every system update is going to need at least 2 gigs, which is very sad.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it will become even more sad if they go up. Like, if they decided at some point they want 2.5 or 3 gig, and then...
I think they pretty much hit the limit, because, like, we were talking about 8 gigabyte phones are screwed now.
Yep.
Okay, I have follow-up for last episode here. So, you sent this to me. Staples turned on Apple Pay support at its retail stores ahead of time for Black Friday. So they're really betting big on Apple Pay. It's going to be nationwide across the U.S. Huge deal. Good job, Staples. Also, there's an article in the show notes about Apple adding support for Union Pay in the App Store. Union Pay is actually very important. It is basically the equivalent to the credit card networks in China, and China is a big market for Apple, so this might be the first step in having Apple Pay in China itself, which would be a huge deal. And that came out like yesterday, so... Great news for everyone in China. They probably can't hear this because our website's probably blocked for some obscure reason in China. And on the super... Oh, go ahead.
I don't know if you had that, but I do have a quick question related to that, and I was not able to find the answer. But before that Union Pay was added, do we know how Chinese were able to buy apps on the App Store?
There was a way to do it, but
because the only way it comes to mind is buying prepaid cards, like prepaid items cards.
There are some countries where that is the only option. I don't think that China is one of them. China might actually have a large enough population of people who have foreign credit cards that it might work out. But yeah, I'm not sure about this exactly. China in itself could be a huge series of episodes on this show, and I'm not familiar enough with the market to actually do those episodes. But if you're interested in that kind of stuff, follow either Ben Thompson on Twitter, who lives in Taiwan and is pretty insightful on this stuff, or read the Tech in Asia blog, which is where this article came from.
And it's kind of...
go ahead.
And small comment, I just want to say that it's kind of funny that I kind of created follow-up while going through our last episode's follow-up, but yeah, so last article?
Yeah, last follow-up is from our first listener submitted follow-up, and that is David from New York, who sent us a correction. Apparently last episode I said something about MetroCard being NFC or contactless in some manner. I know for a fact that that is wrong, but apparently I said the opposite of what I meant to say on the episode. So thank you, David, for saying that, in fact, yes, MetroCard is a magnetic system and not contactless. And that is all for follow-up. So what's this about, a small segment about my new toy?
Yep. So I wanted to have your friend's first impression on your shiny new toy, which is your new PS4.
Yeah, I accidentally bought a PS4.
You cannot accidentally buy something, by the way.
I accidentally brought back some games to trade in and accidentally ended up using the trade-in credit towards a PS4. Yeah, so
Okay, before you start with your first impression, I just want to state something. Since Yannick got his PS4, he's kind of trying to bribe me into buying one, so yeah.
I really want someone to play Drive Club with. I don't have Drive Club yet, but I really want someone to play Drive Club with.
Yeah, and you sent me the link from the PlayStation blog related to those new two Black Friday bundles for the PS4, and oh, crap. So yes, I might buy a PS4 for Black Friday.
Wonderful.
We'll see.
Okay, so before I get into the actual impressions of the device, I should just say why I bought a PS4 this early in the life cycle, because it's atypical for me to buy consoles this early in the life cycle. I mean, it's been a year since the PS4 came out. And it basically boils down to both the big games I'm interested in, which are Destiny and Drive Club, which coincidentally also begin with the letter D. They're social experiences, which will someday die when the servers shut down. And while I don't have any problem believing that Destiny is going to be around for a long time, because they've said many times that they have a quote-unquote 10-year plan for the game, whether or not they actually manage to pull it off is another thing. Like, once those servers go down, I'm never going to be able to relive that experience again, so I have to get in now if I don't want to miss out on it, which is a little bit sad. But many of my friends are on Destiny, and that's the game I got with my bundle, and hopefully by Christmas I will A, have Drive Club, and B, Drive Club will have fixed their servers, which are always down and not working, so that I can enjoy that with somebody, maybe, if they're still around. So PS4 impressions. The PS4 hardware is gorgeous. It is very solid. I haven't loved the PS3 design language that much, but PS4 is really, really nice. Xbox One is also very, very nice, I should say. It's not like Sony Allegiance or anything, but PS4, definitely nice hardware. The UI is, I wouldn't call it fantastic. It's sort of an evolved version of what you have on the PS3. Funnily enough, it's all WebKit. If you actually go look it up on the internet, it's all WebGL stuff that they use for the menus.
All right. I remember, and people were making a fuss about it a year ago when the PS4 launched.
It runs rather smoothly, though there are still frame drops here or there. The really awesome stuff is they really, really tightened up the operating system, where game updates download automatically now. Even without PlayStation Plus, they download automatically, which is great, because on PS3 you needed PlayStation Plus for some reason. So that's really cool. System updates also download automatically, I believe, which is great. You don't actually have to go sit in front of a progress bar every goddamn time you want to play a game, which is great.
And I'm sure I would pay like the price of a new PS4 only to have that feature.
It's a great feature. PlayStation Store, I don't know how much time it takes, but it feels at least like 2 or 3 minutes every time I go on the PS3. On the PS4, it is always loaded in the background, so there is no waiting at all. You just press the PlayStation Store thing and it comes up immediately. No waiting. Brilliant. Personally, I'm more of a fan of the PS Vita UI than I am of the PS4 one. But it gets the job done and it's very effective at what it does. The number one thing I would actually like in the PS4 UI right now is to hide apps that I don't care about. There's like the Playroom, which is the app you can use if you have a PlayStation camera to stream yourself wearing crazy masks and doing weird. It's basically Photo Booth for your PS4, except you can stream it on Twitch, which leads to all kinds of terrible things if you go watch it on Twitch. I wouldn't recommend that if you want to stay sane. But I have no intention to use that. I don't have a PlayStation camera. Can't hide it.
Man, you should buy one, because I can't imagine just like watching you play on your PS4 and doing nothing except playing.
Yeah, well, the Playroom is just like, you can actually see the filters that you're using on the stream. It's not just like the thing. I haven't tried streaming live gameplay, and mostly that's because I suck at Destiny and I don't want people to see me suck at the game. but I should probably do that. The share button, which unfortunately does not play music by the album, the artist share when you press it. For some reason, Twitter sharing seems to fail a lot. But on the other hand, Twitter sharing photos fails a lot for me in general. So I don't know if that's a PS4 thing or if it's just Twitter being Twitter.
So you can share, you can not automatic share, but you can easily share screenshot of the game via on Twitter?
Yeah, so here's what happens. When you press the share button, there's a menu that pops up, and you have basically share a video. So I believe the last 5 minutes or so of gameplay are continuously buffered into a video buffer. So you can actually just share video of the last thing you did if you did something cool. You can do that. You can do screenshot, which will just take whatever is on the screen and let you share it to Facebook, Twitter, or the PSN social network. And there's stream to Twitch and Ustream. You can do one or the other, but you can do it right there, and it's really great. And there's SharePlay, which is if you have PlayStation Plus, you can say, okay, well, I want my friend to help me out in this part of the game. So you can virtually lend your controller to a friend. Or if it's a local multiplayer game, you can say, well, my friend is across the country, but I don't care. I'm going to lend to give him player two spot. Then your game is streamed to him and he's playing.
Yeah, and your friend doesn't need to have a physical or a digital copy of the game. It will
They just need PlayStation Plus.
Oh, my. Oh, yes.
So those are all really, really great features. As much as we love making fun of the share button, those are really cool things.
And now I want a PS4 even more. But honestly, every time I'm remembered of that like virtual second player and it can stream a game to your friend and play with your friend. Oh, man. Honestly, I don't want to go into that subject. But it seems to me that Sony is doing the right thing in this. In this current generation, it seems like they are hitting the right spot every other time. Like, putting the right feature in the console, they are putting everything every gamer wants and all that stuff, and it seems pretty awesome.
Sony has been like very, very aggressively courting developers and asking them, what do you guys want in a system? And it really paid off. And then when Xbox One launched, well, not the launch, but the announcement turned out to be all about sports and TV. They saw how badly you can fuck up your messaging. They said, we're not going to do that. We're going to study every single misstep that Xbox does and undo the stuff. And that sort of sucks because Microsoft wanted to do a lot of very, very ambitious stuff with the Xbox One. But the way they introduced it just didn't come across that way to gamers.
Yeah, exactly, and it seems to me that it's kind of a problem with Microsoft is they have ambitious plan, but every time they would try to execute them, it fails. And I would say that the Xbox One is a failure, but the execution plan to those ambition plans for the Xbox One are a failure, sadly.
Not the execution per se, because they never actually had the chance to execute. The messaging was what they messed up, because when they announced the features, I'm not sure that they were even like done implementing them, but they announced them and gamers said, no way, you're not doing this. So they just said, okay, never mind, we're not doing it. So we never actually got a chance to judge their execution. We just got a chance to judge their messaging and their ability to U-turn quickly.
All right, right, right. Now I'm remembering that situation. Yeah.
So last thing I should talk about is remote play on the PS Vita, because I am maybe one of the biggest PS Vita fans there are.
I would even say that we are. Even if I don't play PS Vita a lot these days, we kind of are both big fans of that console.
Right. So PS Vita, if you're not familiar with the system, and you probably aren't, because look at the sale numbers for it. It is an actual system that exists. Sony might lead you to believe otherwise, but there are actual games for it. Yep. You just have to look very, very hard.
Especially here in North America.
Yeah, basically. Sony of America has given up on the PlayStation Vita. They have basically declared it to be a PS4 accessory at this point. And if you don't have a PS4, you can play the very, very thin library of PS Vita games that have come out in North America. Or you can play on PlayStation Now, which I have not had the chance to try out yet. But yeah, so remote play is this feature which lets you play any PS4 game, actually play anything on your PS4, anything at all, and stream it to your PS Vita so you can play it as if it was another controller.
So it means that it's currently streaming the PS4 screen to your PS Vita?
Yes.
Oh.
And basically any system function you can actually go and tweak. It's not like the PS3 where you could have the XMB and then as soon as you launched an app or a thing, it would kick you out and say, sorry, this doesn't support remote play, and there are only like 15 games over the entire PS3 library that support remote play. None of that. PS4 supports everything. In fact, it's required for every game. It works extremely well. And I'm saying this because Destiny is a first-person shooter. First-person shooters are usually, they demand quick reaction time. And while I would not play multiplayer, like competitive multiplayer with other people on Destiny over remote play, because there is latency, you can feel the latency, but there's too much for it to be playable in competitive multiplayer. For single-player content, however, it is actually fabulous. And I had no trouble going through story missions. And, I mean, the network conditions weren't even ideal most of the time, and I was doing really well. So I love remote play. It's a great feature. But, of course, it's not going to be great on all games because of that latency. So if you're a big multiplayer first-person shooter fan, like, you're not going to be very satisfied with the performance of remote play. But if you're playing mostly single-player games, you're going to love it.
Yeah, because in that case with the multiplayer games, you can have double latency. You have the internet latency and you have your internal Wi-Fi latency.
Exactly. And one of the interesting things, which is turned off by default, but you should probably go turn on if you're going to do this, is you can have your PS4 create a Wi-Fi network dedicated to the PS Vita for remote play. So if you have a wired Ethernet connection, I believe this actually also works if you use a Wi-Fi connection, but I just have the wired Ethernet go directly into the PS4. There's a checkbox in the settings. You can go turn it on, and it improves your latency a lot. So you should go turn that on if you're into remote play stuff.
So it can I create an ad hoc Wi-Fi network only for the PS Vita?
Yeah. Or,
oh, wow. Okay.
I haven't actually, like, use the packet sniffer or whatever to see if I can, if it's a hidden SSID or something, or if it behaves more like the DS, but yeah. So that's pretty much it for my PS4 impressions, unless you got a few questions.
No, except that I kind of hate you right now, and I'm sure you'll continue trolling me in the coming days to buy a PS4.
That's cool. So let's move on to the main topic.
Yep. So, as I said at the top of the show, I kind of want to talk about my current... Yeah, so at the top of the show, I was kind of hesitant about how to proper put words on what I want to speak today about. And so I said I'm kind of trying to promote my iPad to be a first-class citizen computing device in my life. And tonight I'll try to summarize or to put words on feelings that I have related to using my iPad as a personal and professional computing device. But before I start with those, before I start with that, I just want to just remind us a little bit about the iPad history a little bit and the introduction and where does the iPad fits in the mobile device landscape. So if we jump back at the iPad launch in April 2010, we only had a couple of... If we looked at Apple's lineup, we only had a couple of iPhones available on sale and a couple of laptops. If I go through the list, at that time we had the iPhone 3G and the iPhone 3GS. I wanted to note that the iPhone 4 was only released at WWDC 2010, which was in June. So even at the iPad launch, we already knew that the new iPhone was coming because of those leaked iPhone 4 that Gizmodo bought. And yeah. And if we take a look at the laptop size, we add three big devices. So we add the old white MacBook, we add the MacBook Air, and I wanted to note that that MacBook Air I'm referring to is the old one with the shitty hard drive in it. So yeah, it's kind of not that great of a portable device. And obviously we add that big lineup of MacBook Pros ranging from their 13-inch devices that goes as far as 17-inch devices. And obviously, when the iPad launched, it was only one size. And if we compare that with the current landscape of Apple mobile devices, we kind of see that the iPhone lineup was upgraded this year, and they added at least two more devices. So we can see that we're still having the 5C and the 5S available to sale, and Apple introduced the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Apple's in the recent years streamlined their laptop lineups with the MacBook Air in two screen sizes, and same for the MacBook Pro in two screen sizes. And then we look at the iPad mini and iPad normal size lineup. And we see that that's where most of the change happened in the recent years. So if we take a look at that lineup, we see that in the last 2 years, the iPad lineup changed four times. So in October 2012, Apple introduced the iPad 2. So Apple introduced the iPad 4, but the iPad 2 was still around, and it also introduced the iPad mini. In January 2013, Apple introduced the 128GB iPad 4. So that's our first change. Second change in the lineup was in October 2013, when Apple introduced the iPad Air and the iPad Mini 2, at the time known as the iPad Mini with a Retina screen, while still keeping the iPad 2 and the old iPad Mini. And then let's jump in March 2014, which Apple replaced the iPad 2 with the iPad 4 16GB format. And the point I'm trying to drive here is, it seems to me that even if Apple tries to position the iPad as the computing device of the future, Apple is still working and trying to figure out the best way to sell that device and position that device in their mobile device lineup. And it seems to me that they still haven't found the golden lineup for the iPad, and they're kind of doing what they did with the iPad Nano, and so they're kind of working and launching new products and trying stuff in the real world while still seeing the result of those new changes and improving on those. And the comparison I wanted to make with the iPod Nano is, like, for every other year, Apple changes the design completely of the iPod Nano.
Well, except this year.
Yeah, except this year.
I think they've given up on the iPod line. Aside, well, not even aside from the iPod Touch. They've just given up on the iPod line altogether.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I haven't included the iPod line here in mobile devices. Because it seems to me that Apple wanted to replace the iPod with the iPad. It may be a big tangent here because those devices are not in the same category, I would say, even if they are like personal devices. It's kind of easy to say that like the iPad can play music, but the iPod cannot go on the internet. But even then, if we go back during the iPod time, everybody that has an iPod has a real connection with that device. And it seems to me that even if the iPhone is here, Apple wants to move that connection to, like, that physical and emotional connection from the iPod to the iPad.
I'm not sure about that. I think that a lot of the confusion you're seeing in the iPad lineup has to do with the iPad mini existing. I think that Steve Jobs was actually, like, he wasn't lying when he gave his rant about 7-inch tablets back in the day. I think that iPad mini was sort of this thing that came out of nowhere that they did because there was such strong consumer demand, because they were seeing Kindle Fire and they were seeing, I don't think the Nexus 7 was out. Like, it came out a couple months earlier, so it wouldn't have been like the influencing product, but like Galaxy Tabs and stuff like that. Those didn't sell very well. I think probably the Kindle Fire had to be the one that sold the best, and even then we don't have sale numbers for it. But I think that consumer knowledge that those devices are out there and that that form factor is a form factor that exists was enough to pressure them into making the iPad mini. And then the entire game became, well, how do we maintain parity between the mini and the big size? And obviously they're not anymore, or at least not this year. And trying to keep that parity and juggle the two form factors really just made it so that they ignored the big form factor and the potential it had to be the next big computing device. Because now they have this mini that they're attached to, and they have no choice but to keep maintaining the mini because consumers are out there asking for it and buying a lot of them.
And I didn't even say that maybe Apple forgot to think and like tinker with the bigger iPad. I would just think that they haven't found a way to just make those two iPad live together and to really promote those two devices properly.
So here's the thing. I think the big iPad, iPad Air 2 right now, that is the MacBook Air of the future. That form factor and that price point is going to be the MacBook Air of the future with regards to where Apple is headed. The problem is, now there's this mini thing, and this mini thing is too inexpensive and has too low margins to actually be on par with the big one. So now they're sort of, their hands are tied. They basically have to either decide, well, do we go ahead and screw the mini users by making the big one max potential and go ahead, it's going to be a full computing device that, I mean, like that Pixelmator demo in the keynote was insane. Like, I can see a lot of people adopting the iPad Air 2 as their only computer going forward. And I really encourage like the iPad because I think that's the future of computing. But I look at the small iPad, I'm like, well, what's the price right now for the iPad Mini, like the iPad Mini 3? It's like $399?
It's $399.
Yeah. I'm not convinced they can take the iPad Air 2 and fit it into that price range and get away with it. It might also be a battery thing, because that's the other thing. You've got the battery capacity to worry about with the iPad Mini because it's a smaller device, so you have smaller battery. So you have different concerns. And before when the iPad mini didn't exist, you didn't have those trade-offs to consider at all during product development. You were focused on the big device, and you believed strongly, well, at least Steve Jobs did, that the 9.7-inch device is the right size. It is the size going forward for the innovation you have in mind. Steve Jobs is gone now. I'm not going to say that it's because Steve Jobs isn't there that they thought this, but now you have this this almost 8-inch thing, and you've got it at a lower price point, and that limits you in what you can do unless you want to segment the product line going forward. And, like, I can see the way when you were talking about, like, iPad replacing iPod, what I thought about was immediately the iPad mini, because the iPad mini is basically the iPad that replaces the iPod Touch for many people. And by many people, I mean I want to buy an iOS device so my little kid can play games. That is the market of the iPad mini.
Yeah, it would seem so. And if we compare it to the latest, quote-unquote latest, iPod Touch, it would seem that the iPad mini will be a better deal.
It is.
Because even then, you'll be able to get it, I would say a little bit cheaper, but I'm not really sure what's the price right now of the iPod Touch. But it's around the price.
It's $249.
Oh, so if it's $249, it's about the same price.
Actually, I'm not sure anymore, because I'm sure there's a really low-end one.
Yeah, I'm sure it's around the price of the iPad mini first gen right now.
So it shouldn't exist.
Yeah, obviously. But if we continue on that tension, meaning that the iPad mini will replace the iPod Touch for kids, the iPad mini at $249
needs to... The iPod Touch is $199, by the way.
Okay. But even then, at that price point, I will see a case for that old iPad mini to still exist.
Yeah, but it still shouldn't exist because it's a bad device.
Yeah, developers don't like that device, like they don't like the iPad 2, but
I can't wait until I have to actually test my app on that device. I haven't done it yet.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Oh my, you'll cry.
It's just going to be slower.
I hope it will just be slower.
I hope so.
Yeah, so the point I was trying to make here was, it seems to me that Apple is more focusing on the lineup than the bigger picture that the iPad is bringing on to the table.
Well, what is the bigger picture that the iPad is bringing to the table? Because Apple isn't making a very good case for why the iPad exists right now. Like, the past 2 years, especially, they've been like, well, here's this iPad. We don't know what it does, but it does stuff. We should buy one. $500.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe this is the best way to put why I'm still having issues to use my iPad every day and to make more stuff with my iPad. And when I mean more stuff, is just not use my iPad as a consumption device. Because we all know that at first, the iPad was marketed as a consumption device.
Well, it was marketed as a consumption device because it's really, really good at being a consumption device. But
yeah, and I'm never like saying that it's not good at it. But if it wants to move in the future, it should be good also at doing something else. Like, it should be better at being on the productive side and not only on the consumption side.
Well, it depends, right? So I think it's the Your Verse campaign. God, I hate that campaign because it's so abstract and weird and stuff. But recently, Apple's marketing campaigns have been like, look at these people using the iPad for work in scenarios where a laptop is completely infeasible. So you have like people on oil rigs that would be normally using a clipboard and paper that are now using iPads and getting their jobs done more efficiently because of that. So the iPad is a very important work device for those people, but the problem is we don't have those jobs, so we don't see it that way.
Yeah, maybe that's a problem. I need to...
Or like pilots. Like, pilots are a huge deal because airplane companies airplane companies are saving a bunch of money because now they don't have to lug around all of those flight maps. They can just put an iPad and load the app on it, and the flight maps are all on the iPad. And literally stacks and stacks of paper are now no longer on airplanes because they can carry their iPad. So, like, there are very, very big productivity benefits with the iPad. They're just in places we don't see.
And do you think that since they are in place we don't see, it might impact the future of the iPad, or it just might say that in Apple is still thinking about those other places?
I'm not sure Apple knows what they want the iPad to be. I know that they can look at, like, what customers are doing with their iPad and say, okay, we have a rough idea of what they're doing with it. We should market some of that, maybe, if there is something like an ingenious use, like the uses I was talking about, like the pilots and the oil rig people. But they don't seem to have a vision for how does the iPad become the computer that is on everyone's, not on everyone's desk, because it's not a desktop computer, but you know what I mean. Like,
to be in everyone's hand, for example.
Right. How do we, like, replace every MacBook Air we sell with an iPad, or most of them anyway? I don't think they have, like, the vision planned for that. I think Steve Jobs might have. Because if you think about it, if you actually go read, like, Steve Jobs' biography, well, not the Steve Jobs biography, it wasn't very good, but if you go read a lot of, like, Apple literature about what they were like when they were building the Mac, the iPad is the Mac, basically. It's what they wanted to build with the Mac. They just weren't able to do it because the technology was so basic back then. But, like, what Steve Jobs wanted was, here is an appliance computer that you can just use. And I believe that for that vision, the iPad succeeded very much. And for people who don't do very much productive work on their computers, like, I hate to fall back on parents because that's like a lazy.
No, but it's a good example
to choose. But
and that's the main reason why I'm bringing that subject up is, my mom recently, like 6 months ago, bought an iPad Mini, and since she bought that device, like, she found a way to be more comfortable using a computer, and she feel empowered by using the iPad, while when she was using a PC or a Mac, she was, like, lost and confused and scared. But the problem that got me thinking about that was, I know how to use a computer, I know how to feel safe, and I know how all of my stuff is on my Mac, but I'm still having issues how to properly use my iPad and to be powerful with my iPad, productive with my iPad.
Well, yeah, there are, like, two points in there. The first is about knowing where all your stuff is and being a power user for computers. The direction Apple is headed in is very, I don't want to say anti-power user, but it's at odds with power users. Like, if you take into consideration, like, the iCloud ideal, which they sort of backed away from, of no file system, it is very, very, very disconcerting to power users that there is no file system, because you don't know where your shit is, and you don't know how to back it up, and you don't know if it still exists, which with iCloud is not always a given. So,
but even then, at that point, I would give away the notion of a file system if I'm able to say, just, I'm dropping my files in a place, which, call it whatever you want, but that I could be 100% sure that I will be able to find it after that. And that's why it's comforting to use a file system for nerds or for power users. We know where our stuff is.
Well, it's not just that. It's that with iCloud in particular, but there are certainly other technologies that I just can't remember off the top of my head. Like, when something screws up, what do you do? Because Apple does a very, very good job of hiding errors from users generally. Like when your Apple TV says, sorry, I don't want to log into your iTunes account, screw you. And now all of your iTunes content isn't viewable, which is something that happens like every 2 weeks for Merlin Mann, apparently. Like, what do you do? You have no recourse because Apple bundles like these atomic units of experiences. And if you try to peer into those atoms, well, sorry, only Apple can peer into those. Well, in theory, only Apple can peer into those. So you have like no recourse if something goes wrong. And that is like the big problem with iOS. Like one of the big issues I have with iOS is it's 2014, like 7 years later, maybe more. And like when I delete a game, I still don't have that game's save data that I can restore at any other time if I decide to reinstall the app. Like that seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah, and it's goes it go and it goes back to the fact that I was like just put my all my data somewhere that I'm sure it's safe and I'm sure that I can be able to find it at a later time. Because if you seem like you just said, if I'm deleting an app and that save data is gone because you deleted an app, it could be nice that you when you reinstall it, it's back up and.
Or like not even that, like the notion of backup and restore on iOS, okay?
What?
If the notion of backup and restore on iOS.
Exactly what?
Okay, well, let me just go into this. So the idea is you have a device, you back it up, and then you buy a new device and you restore. But what if like your backup is basically an atomic thing, like I was talking about, that contains everything. It contains all your documents, it contains all your settings, it contains potentially Springboard settings that may be corrupt, that if you restore it, well, you will continue to have the same bug you've been having on your new device. There is no interface to delete that Springboard preference file. I'm using Springboard as an example. I'm not saying that it's going to be Springboard because it's probably not, but like if you have a preference file that is corrupt, or something that has happened to me numerous times is the artwork cache for iTunes for the music app. If your artwork cache for the music app is screwed up, good luck fixing it if you don't have a jailbroken device. The solution is you don't have a solution.
I guess your solution is just erase your phone and start a new backup.
Yeah, because even if you go into iTunes and uncheck the music checkbox and then you recheck it, somehow it still doesn't work. And then you're like, well, what the hell am I supposed to do now? Like, there are tons of little irritating things like this in iOS that it would be fine if the presumption was that it just works. And like, if you go look back to like 2004 Apple, yeah, it did just work. And nobody complained about those problems. But now we're in 2014 where we had an entire episode about like iOS 8 bugs. Like, it doesn't just work anymore. And now, because it doesn't just work, those atomic experiences are just infuriating to deal with. And I'm not saying that Android is better, obviously, because otherwise I would be using an Android phone.
Yeah, and exactly. And it also seems, and I also have the feeling related to those atomic experiences, that Apple is still sticking to those. That it still thinks that after 7 years of sticking to those with iOS, and every like most user ran into big issues with those.
No, but that's the thing. It is the good direction to go in. I don't argue the idea of atomic experiences. I think it is the right idea because it simplifies everything for everyone. The problem is, if it doesn't work, then you're fucked. And the problem is, these days, it doesn't work more often than it does work. And it should just work like it did in 2004, 10 years ago. So anyway, I sort of went on a huge tangent and derailed you from your main topic. But
no, but that's fine. That's fine. Because in that quote-unquote topic, I'm still trying to find words to explain what I'm trying to say here. Like, it still feels to me like something like away from me in a way. It's kind of like
it's out of your control completely.
Yes, and it's like the fact that I'm not in control of it scared the shit out of me. Because you see, I see that shiny new thing in front of me, which is an iPad 2. iPad Mini 2. Not an iPad 2. Oh, my. But
that's not shiny at all.
It's mostly rusty at that point. But yeah. where I was. Oh, yeah. So I see that iPad in front of me. I want to use it. But every time I'm trying to do something, I hit those rough edges. That's put me back in front of my Mac and say, like, oh, whereas that's my comfort zone. And
well, that's why it's easy for power users, Mac power users in particular, to dismiss the iPad as a consumption device. Because when you're consuming stuff, you don't really run into those frustrations about, like, where your stuff is, because a lot of the times you're going to be streaming anyway. Like, it's on a server somewhere that is out of your control anyway. So it's not going to, like, well, it might suddenly disappear if it's a Taylor Swift album, but otherwise.
Oh, don't start me on that.
That would be a good topic, but I think a lot of people are going to cover it, and they're going to do a better job. But, like, when you're consuming stuff, you're not, like, if something goes away, you're like, okay, well, I have something else to consume, probably. I mean, like, there's no shortage of stuff to watch on the internet. Like, you'll find something else. Whereas, if it's something you do for work, well, if it goes away, well, suddenly you have to do that work again, and that's, like, sort of infuriating. Well, not just sort of, it is infuriating.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I want to work now, I can't, and I'm sure that I won't be paid for just doing nothing at my desk. So, or, like, go on, pardon me.
Well, I was going to ask, like, what are the limitations you run into with iOS with regards to doing stuff aside from your job is programming and there is no Xcode on the iPad?
Except that.
Aside from that big thing.
Exactly. Aside from that big thing, which I would love to have Xcode on my iPad. But aside from that, since we started that podcast, I'm trying to write my thoughts on the iPad. And I'm using editorial to do that, which is really nice. But my problem is, like, I'm still having issues moving data from one app to another. And I do know that those new iCloud Drive APIs will fix that for me. But we all know that we need developer support for that, and that's coming in the future. So I guess my rant about the iPad might be fixed in the future and everything will be right and I will be wrong and all that stuff. But still now, I'm still not feeling in control when I want to do something on my iPad, and that's infuriating me.
But, like, particularly, what's the issue that requires iCloud Drive to get your data from one place to another? Like, when you're typing stuff into a text field, I'm not sure I get really...
No, but what's, I guess, I mean, like, if I want to upload that file to somewhere else, for example, Dropbox, or that's nice because in editorial, there's Dropbox support, but some other, I do have some notes in Notes.app that I would like to have on the other devices, which are not iCloud enabled. I know they're not iCloud enabled, that might be my problem, but, like, if it's text that I'm having issue to transfer from one app to another, imagine when I want to transfer a picture from one app to another. And I still know that those features will come in the future.
But, like, transferring text from one place to another, like, copy and paste exists. I mean, when it works, which, again, iOS 8 bugs episode, we should have mentioned that too. There are lots of copy and paste bugs in iOS 8 as well, and they're still not fixed. But, when it works, which is luckily most of the time, I mean, you can use that to move that pretty much anywhere, unless you're using something with a really, really custom text view.
No, you're right, but as we all know, copying text is kind of a pain. You know, like, if I have all my text in a file, I should be able to move the file and not copy the content of it and all that stuff.
Yeah, no. Well, what you need is, like, an open-end file for text in every text app. Actually, one of the things I thought was really weird when they launched extensions is you can't just select a bunch of text and then in the callout view that has copy paste and all that, there should have been a little share sheet button that just brings up the share sheet and lets you do stuff with extensions directly there. I'm very surprised that wasn't there.
On a small note related to that, it seems that when the initial team that's worked on iOS in 2007, they kind of had an idea about including services as they are on the Mac on iOS. And from what we heard about the Scott Forstall team, their first designs related to that before Forstall decided to just ditch that idea was related to those popover when you select text.
Yeah. And that made me sad when I heard that Forstall shut it down because he thought that it would be littered with too many third-party options. And actually, to look at like extensions menus and most specifically the Notification Center widget menus, yeah, I can understand why he said no. But it still would have been nice for para users.
I know you kind of were making fun of me already when I was when you were asking like what's your issue, like what's your issue with transferring data and all that stuff, and I guess that's the better way to explain my feelings right now related to how I can be productive with my iPad. Is like it feels to me like it's tonight is going to be a feeling episode. So, like, those feelings are strange to me. Like, it feels to me that an iPad is kind of like my mom using a computer to me.
Yeah, well, it's because it's accessible to her as well.
No, I mean, like, for her, it's something completely, like, miles away from her. Like, she's still having issues to use it, but that's fine. But I feel like her when I use my iPad, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, like her on a desktop computer, you mean?
Yeah, pardon me. I use iPad when I wanted to say desktop computer.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can sort of understand that. I mean, it's new. The thing with Apple is you have to embrace the new stuff or else you get left behind pretty quickly. I get the guilt every week when my computer tells me to update to Yosemite and I still haven't done it because I'm trying to ship my app. I can understand. But
honestly, that might be part of my problem because sometimes I do feel like I'm an old man that age changes.
You're not an old man. You're not old man.
I know. Which is funny when I say that I'm an old man and I think like an old man related to that is. Every time I feel like powerless, like when I want control and I don't have it, I feel like I'm like pushing change away. And that might be why I'm kind of having a love-hate relationship with my iPad right now.
So maybe what you should do, well, I don't want to like give advice without you asking for it, but I will anyway. what you should do is like give yourself a challenge to when you're off work, just use the iPad full time and don't even open your computer unless like work calls and you have to, because that will get you over the barrier very, very quickly. I did it earlier when my iPad, not my iPad, when my iMac died. I basically decided, okay, I'm going to put the laptop on sleep whenever I'm not working and do everything on the iPad. And that is where I got a lot of my workflows figured out for getting stuff done on the iPad.
I'm kind of halfway there because, honestly, on my left right now, there's my iMac in its box. And on my right, there's my laptop open and recording that podcast. So I might be able to start thinking about doing that and maybe like forcing myself to use my iPad when I'm not working. And not coding apps. Oh, for the iPad. Ta ta ta.
Another thing that is really useful if you're doing something like side projects that aren't directly related to work is do everything you can in your side projects to ensure that it can be done on an iOS device. And I'm speaking mostly about like Polyphonic Room. Originally, for a long, long time, for the first year and a half or so, the only way I could post anything to the site was via a series of scripts on my phone, which is ridiculous and a complete hack, but it was the only way I could do it.
Oh, right. I remember that time. And I still have that... what's the name of that app that you use? That MyScript. Yeah, still have it on my iPad. Did nothing on it, but...
I still use it for a bunch of legacy scripts I have lying around, and I would use Pythonista, except Python Unicode support sucks, so that's why I'm not using Pythonista. But yeah, like, if you can get as much of your workflows going forward on iOS first and then figure the Mac part out, it becomes a lot easier to do stuff. And the other trick, of course, is to read, like, all the stuff that Federico Vitici wrote over at Mac Stories about using Launch Center Pro, using Pythonista. Sometimes it becomes really, really weird to figure out, like, the way in which you should use it, because, like, your workflows aren't going to be the same as his because you don't necessarily have a blog about, like, iOS stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But every time I read one of Vitici's article related to his workflow, I'm like, oh, man. Like, it seems to me that might not be the first step to do, because, like, he's miles away from where I am right now.
And I believe I saw this in a few of his screenshots. I don't know if the app got rejected because it suddenly disappeared from all his home screen screenshots. But there was an app called Workflow. A couple of years ago, I had an idea that I might want to write, like, Automator for iOS. Well, that's basically what that app is, so I'm glad I didn't do it because they did a much better job than I would have done. And it's by, I believe his name is Ari Weinstein, which was one of the Jailbreak people, Rx from the Jailbreak community back in the day. He is apparently working on that project, so that's cool.
Yeah, I guess I just need to... jump on the bandwagon and just need to start using my iPad, like, fully.
Yeah, because, like, today, for everything I do, if I had a quote-unquote real job, which means not being an indie developer and doing anything, but if I went somewhere that had a computer or if I had a work laptop that was separate from everything, I could do everything I do on the iPad right now. And I would probably like it more than having, like, a split of Mac and iPad stuff.
And when you say that you could do everything on that you're currently doing everything on your iPad, those include your side projects?
Well, aside from recording a podcast on Skype.
Exactly.
But everything else, yeah, I could do pretty much. Largely thanks to apps like Diet Coda and stuff like that. Which make the task a lot easier, and now Transmit, which is a godsend, really. So you should take a look at, like, the cool apps that came out recently. They're really cool. I'm looking forward to more automation apps that use iOS 8 extension stuff, because there are very few of them right now, and I hope that Apple doesn't reject a bunch of them, because that, for a while, I was worried about that, especially, like, there was a launcher that would let you open URL scheme stuff directly from the notification widget, and it got pulled from the store.
And today we learned that I don't remember the name of the app, but the app that was able to put a not able, but they kind of act a keyboard in the notification center and to take notes, and they kind of got the Apple call saying that, oh, guys, remove that or you'll be pulled out of the store.
What's very strange about that is that very often those apps will get pulled from the North American store. Well, they'll get pulled from all stores, but I mean apps that are in English and are primarily targeting the North American store will get shut down much, much quicker than apps in, like, let's say, the Japanese store. There is a lot of crazy stuff that Apple pulled apps from the App Store from that continues to go on in the Japanese App Store with no problems. And like Launch Center, originally Launch Center, right, it was put notifications that open various things in Notification Center, and they approved it, and then very quickly they said, oh yeah, by the way, no, you can't do that. So it got pulled. But there's an app from the developer of MyScripts called My Shortcuts, which basically does exactly that. And that one hasn't been pulled from the App Store at all. And I'm happy that it didn't, because it's actually very useful, and I still use it from time to time to do stuff, because it's actually quicker to just pull down the notification shade and do stuff. And like for a really long time on iOS 7, the animation to open the multitasking switcher took forever. So it was actually much, much quicker to switch apps by bringing down the notification shade and using URL schemes to switch between them than to actually multitask using the multitasking switcher. But in 7.1, they actually just made the animation faster, and that made me happy.
I guess I'll conclude my quote-unquote topic by saying that I would like to hear from you guys if you have any tips and tricks. Oh, come on tonight.
Tips and tricks.
Thank you, Yannick. So, yeah, I won't say it again because I'm sure I'll screw it again, but if you have any advice for me related to be more productive using the iPad, just ping me on Twitter and I'll would like to see those.
Yeah, there are a bunch of apps you should check out. There.
Maybe that's what I'll do during Christmas time.
Yeah. I mean, like, Launch Center Pro, I really, really want to use more, but
Funny enough, I installed it a while ago on my phone, and I think it's still installed on my iPad. And I don't know what to do in those apps. Like, I know what it can do, but I don't know what to do to help me.
Well, a lot of the time it comes down to, like, do the apps that you use have URL schemes? And A, are they in the Launch Center Pro database? Because if they're not, then you might as well not know about them. Like, if there are a lot of undocumented URL schemes out there, like Line, for example, there are a bunch of crazy URL schemes for that, but nobody ever talks about them. Or like Facebook Messenger, you can't do anything like, or maybe you can, it's just undocumented. Like, I would love to have a Facebook Messenger thing where I can just send a message to a specific person directly from a URL scheme, but as far as I know, you can't. Line, as far as I know, you can send it text and it will show you a list of people to send it to, and you just press the name of the person you want to send it to, and then the text will be pre-populated in the text field, but then you have to actually press the send button. So it's actually like a bunch of taps that you have to do instead of just like send me to the app and I just press one more thing to confirm and it's done. And even as an app developer myself, like, some of the things you want to offer aren't things that can be done very easily with URL schemes. Like, for the app I'm working on, I would love to have, like, URL schemes that let you open specific things, but then there's so much more you have to manage. Like, if your app doesn't support having multiple documents open at the same time, which probably it doesn't because it's an iOS app, then you have to either ask the user, well, you don't ask the user to save, but I guess the problem is really specific to the app I'm working on more than anything else, so maybe I should shut up.
No, but even then, I'm sure that other developers saw those issues and still are trying to find a good way to handle those issues.
And, like, extensions aren't perfect. I do want to look into extensions, but the problem is I've been so busy trying to get the basic functionality of my app ready to ship that I haven't had time to look at them.
Yeah. And it also seems to me that maybe I decided to have that conversation a little bit late regarding that all of those, maybe all of my gripes related to using my iPad more often will be fixed when more apps supported those extensions. Or add new powerful extensions.
Yeah, it's sort of surprising how many apps held off on that this year. I think they announced so much stuff that I can sort of understand that, like, yeah, I'm going to take some time to work on this thing and then prioritize something else. It's also that I think a lot of developers of these apps in question experience the same, not concerns, but worries about iOS as a productive platform as you do, because as developers, we literally can't use the iPad for our job, and that limits how we can see iOS is a productive platform.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of strange that I'm here talking about how the iPad can how I feel that I'm not able to be productive on my iPad, and I'm like working and every day building an iPad, which is a POS system that empowers people to be productive on the iPad.
Exactly.
So I guess it goes back to what you were saying at the beginning, related to those pilots, and the iPad might be better to be productive for some people in some workflow, and maybe I need to start to be okay with the fact that I won't be as productive as I want to be on the iPad.
Well, the other thing to take into consideration is Apple's not going to cry if you continue to buy a Mac. They make more money off the Mac you buy than on the iPad you buy. Like, it's no big deal. In fact, they probably prefer it if you bought an iPhone 6 Plus because they make even more money off of that. Because it's like $800. But
speaking of the iPhone 6 Plus, oh man. Yeah.
It's huge.
It's huge.
Actually, I haven't seen one yet.
Oh, it's huge. And I mean, funny enough, it might be the iPhone 6 Plus might be part of my solution.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know.
Oh no.
Maybe
you're becoming one of those people.
I know. Maybe what I need is only one device.
Oh god.
Except a computer.
We need an intervention.
I thought that episode was an intervention.
Oh god. Well, the problem is a lot of apps are, well, it's not really a problem, it's an understandable thing. A lot of apps are launching iPhone first or universal, and I'm going to be like super hypocritical because like I'm doing that myself. I decided to make my app universal, so whatever. But if all of the productivity apps go on the iPhone first or only, there's less of a case to be made for the iPad, even though there is some value in having a larger screen. But for the longest time, like Line wasn't available on the iPad, and recently it did, like last month it did. And now I'm very, very happy because I don't have to use a series of hacks to get like links over from one device to the other to send them to you.
Exactly.
Like it was crazy. I had if this and that send links from one copy of Launch Center Pro to the other, and it was a big mess. And then it opened a URL scheme to Lion, and it was insane.
Yeah, I wasn't that crazy.
Copy a URL and go over.
Yeah, I wasn't that crazy to do that. I was trying to find a way to just send that link to my Mac, most of the time using iCloud tabs, and then paste it to you. But even then, when I was on my iPhone, I was like, oh, I need to send that. That's fine. And I'm on my iPad? Crap. How can I get that URL to a friend? Like, how can I share that? Because, like you said, so much apps are still iPhone first.
Yeah,
and that might be part of the problem, that why I'm having issues imagining a future for the iPad, because lots of devs, including maybe both of us, are thinking iPhone first.
Well, I'm not thinking iPhone first. I should clarify that. So my app, I haven't actually mentioned what it is on the show yet, and I'm trying not to mention it because I want it to be a surprise.
Yeah,
instead of having people asking me constantly what it is. I mean, like, a handful of people know what it is.
And obviously, I don't want to force you to say what it is.
Yeah. My app was designed iPad first. Its UI was going to be something... Originally, its UI was going to be something very much suited to the iPad. And then I saw what Facebook did with Facebook Paper. And by no means my app is going to be as good as Facebook Paper. Like, I should be very clear about that. I don't even think they're on the same footing. But it made me rethink completely how I was designing my UI. And it just happened that the UI I made works very well on the iPhone. Maybe not in portrait yet, but in every other orientation it does. And there's only one other orientation, so whatever. But Like, if I can expose my app to that market, I would be dumb not to do it. Especially, like, the App Store is a tough business. I want all the audience I can get, right? So I decided to make my app universal. And the upside is now I have smaller test devices on my desk all day instead of having the big iPad on the desk all day.
Oh, that's a tough problem.
Yeah. Hopefully, like, by the end of the year, we'll have an episode about what my app is and the design decisions I took, but that's not for now.
Yeah, I hope we will.
So is that it for this week's episode?
Yep.
Okay, so if you want to see the show notes for this episode, you should go to limitlesspossibility.net/3. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @limipo_podcast. That's @limipo_podcast. I am at @sakurina on Twitter. That's @sakurina. And you are
at @lukonouche, @lukonouche.
And we'll see you again in 2 weeks. In fact, in 2 weeks, I should preface this with a little backstory. I'm going to be in Boston taking the Japanese language proficiency test. And I am probably going to fail it. But next episode, we are going to be talking about language learning. And that means not only verbal language learning, but also computer programming language learning and how they relate to each other. So it's going to be a slight deviation from the tech topics that you've grown to expect from us, but it should be good. So we'll see you next time.